I understand. But still, it felt like getting 86'd from your barber for going bald. We weren't totally broke, but I was preparing for it. We did what we called free shopping, where I would call all the 800 numbers on the groceries in the cupboard to complain. I'd done this a lot over the years by writing fantastical complaint letters to companies just to see if they'd respond. They were outlandish and were mostly just for entertainment purposes to post on my website. Now it was to actually get free food or sundry bullshit. Bingo was still in and out of the depths of crazy and was highly amused by extreme silliness, so I would make all the calls like prank calls. I can't do characters, so I did them all like the only goofy voice I could, Saul Rosenberg from the Jerky Boys. If you don't know who that is, Google it and come back when you know this voice.
Yes, hello. Thank you then. Oh, yes, I'm calling about your Rembrandt toothpaste, yes? Yes, thank you. I've been using your product ever since back when I was asked to leave parochial school. I love it. I simply love it. But I just bought a tube from the local mercantile and it tasted funny. I don't know what was wrong with it.
What do you mean by it tasted funny?
You know, it was stingy. It tasted almost tangential, like it might have been left out in the sun. You have to understand, I'm on a limited budget.
The complaints were absurd, but it made Bingo laugh, and customer service would only try to pretend to understand for so long before relenting and sending you coupons for free product. They don't give a shit. They work in a call center and are happy enough that you're not yelling at them. After 2 hours of doing this for the first time, we ended up collecting about $250 worth of free shit. Keep in mind that a lot of the coupons require the checkout person to fill in minutiae with a pen. We filled two carts full on that first $250, and it took us almost 45 minutes to check out. The checkout lane spilled into the aisle behind us until they got a second checker to handle the overflow. Stares of hatred burned into the backs of our heads. Not a good way to ingratiate yourselves to the natives. Jesus, Douglas, we're trying to fit into a new town and this is what you do? Still, we were hooked on our new scam, mostly for the entertainment value of making the calls. Mother would sit in on a lot of them, just like watching me pitch in the old phone room days. We soon developed a system that made it easier and more profitable. Once I knew what different codes and dates on the packaging that customer service would ask for, we no longer needed to even have the product on our shelf. I could simply go to the grocery store, write it all down from the largest size of that product on the shelf, along with the toll-free number, and we'd get even bigger shit for free without ever having to buy it in the first place. Free coupons would roll in like checks from our days of selling pens. Mother and Bingo would roar at the calls loud enough that they'd have to leave the room to not queer the deal. Without them as an audience, I probably would have never kept doing it. I jacked up Mother to start making calls herself. There aren't any real jobs in Bisbee for skilled people, much less someone in her condition. Even if she were physically able at this point, the last thing a hippie town needs is another massage therapist. She'd been fired by the Korean massage joint in L.A. when some cocksucker complained about her incessant cough. She'd never cut it in this town of yoga and chakra healing. She could at least make a few bogus phone calls during the day to help offset living costs. She didn't even have to make them funny or affect the Saul Rosenberg voice. She just had to complain, nicely, 3 times a day, and she'd have no grocery bills. If there was anything that Mother was skilled in, it was complaining. But she wouldn't do it. She was afraid she'd get in trouble. "You've always got away with this kind of shit. I know that I'd get in trouble. I'm different than you." "Ma, you're not going to get into trouble just for making a complaint. Do it 15 minutes a day and almost never spend a dime on groceries. Times are precarious. There are 4 of us and I'm the only one with a job. How hard can it be?" It was the easiest way I could find for Mother to contribute to the collective without having to expend any real energy. Still, Mother wouldn't even put in that much. I know a bunch of you will after reading this. Email me when you've paid for this book and more from that fun little pastime. Or just send me free coupons after you've stolen this book off the internet. Either way, honor amongst thieves. Bingo and I went on the road for most of that fall and didn't get back until near Thanksgiving of 2005. Thanksgiving that year would mark 25 years since I'd first gotten drunk and smoked cigarettes behind Tatnik School, so I decided that I'd quit both for the 30 days in between then and Christmas. Bingo hated to see me smoking, especially considering the state into which Mother was deteriorating. On the 15th day of my detox, and after a lot of broken, inanimate objects, we figured we'd do some mushrooms. By mid-trip, not only was I drinking and smoking again, but even Bingo had started smoking as well.
We still had plenty of mushrooms, and on Christmas Eve, we convinced Mother she should trip with us. This was a terrible idea for a woman with that much emotional baggage, but since she was still drinking, as were we overlooked the possible hazards. Unlike cocaine, Mother didn't take well to psilocybin. She just laid on her couch with her eyes closed, moaning and coughing and asking how long before this would all be over. I went in as some podunk security guard character, talking like Billy Bob Thornton in Sling Blade, who kept having to go outside with a flashlight to check the perimeters. I never left character, and it kept Bingo in hysterics. Never try to explain why something nonsensical was funny while you were tripping. It just was. At some point, Mother came out of her half-coma and erupted with, "I want to get laid!" She wasn't meaning presently, just in general, again, sometime in life. She hadn't been with a man since Michael, maybe 10 years or more. She just blurted it out and then fell silent and wheezing again. But this declaration for us on mushrooms was very off-putting, lingering like a smell. It put the ill in buzzkill. I went out to check the perimeter. Father Luke was with us, and he was a clean and sober guy, but the kind of clean and sober that always seems to be tripping harder than you regardless. Once Mother was over the hump and could move, we had Father Luke drive us around. This was a regular pastime for us. Bisbee is a tripper's paradise, even in the boring residential area where we live. All the houses are different, built mostly in the early 1900s as miners' shacks and then further built upon. On mushrooms at night, under dim streetlights, they're amazing, like you've been shrunken down and put into the village of an elaborate toy train set. There's generally zero activity at night, and Father Luke would drive us all over down these weird back alleys, dirt roads, and occasionally right through the police station parking lot just to scare the shit out of us. Tonight, we dressed Mother and Bingo in top hats, poured drinks to go, and took to the streets on a mushroom booze cruise of Bisbee. I played the song Mother from Pink Floyd's The Wall on the CD player. It was still religion to me from my first trip picking blotter acid out of my own hurl. I could always find parallels with the movie in the years since, mostly the internal emotional deadening of a longtime boozer. Oftentimes after a particularly hard bit of... I'm leaving that in. Bit of drunken late show that queered the audience. I'd take a moment in the stunned silence or nervous titters, pause, and then belt out a line from In the Flesh. The song Mother obviously struck close to home, and I thought Mother hearing it for the first time on our first psychedelic trip together would be a bonding moment. Mother just talked over it or told us to turn it down. I guess the lyrics are about an oppressive, cloistering mother, but that's not what it meant to me. Either way, the sentiment was lost. We wound up at St. Elmo's, a bar in Old Bisbee, and took a table in the back. After a few cocktails, Mother got loose and fun, and after a couple more, she got downright maudlin. A strong mushroom trip can bring you straight down into melancholy. Mother, decked out in Father Luke's top hat and my long wool overcoat, had moved into the when I die phase of conversation. She told Bingo with a tremble in her mumbled voice, "Before I go, I need to show you the right way to cheap wrap and ship." Nobody knew what the fuck she was talking about until we realized she was referring to the way she ships the merchandise she handled from my website orders. She said it with all the seriousness of an elderly Italian grandmother about to pass down the secret family recipe for the marinara. After a beat of looking at each other confused, we all burst into rolling head-on-the-table laughter that didn't stop. Why is that funny? There's a certain way to do it, which brought even more laughs. When I was finally able to form words, I tried to explain to her that it was funny that she thought that was all she'd gleaned from life to pass on to her next of kin. This made her erupt into more tears, mostly because of the way I said it. It came out wrong. Maybe she really did feel like that's all she had to pass on from 60 years of living. Cheap and efficient forms of mailing DVDs and t-shirts, rife with cat hair and nicotine. That was the only contribution she could hold on to that she felt she was making. And we shit on her just as she was about to let us in on it. I was hoping that mushrooms would give her some gravely needed insight, some higher perception of herself, or allow her to come to terms with some of her demons. I wasn't trying to divine how to cut corners at the post office. This night kicked off another 2-week binge period for Mother of heavy drinking and slurred, desperate, ending it all phone calls. It was her loneliness, her fear, her pain, and her declining health. It was hard for me to accept that first off, Mother was just really a shitty drunk. Not that all of her other problems weren't very real, it's just that alcohol seemed to exasperate them, where for me, alcohol hid my problems very well. I'm all for drinking away your problems, but she was drinking them to front row center. I told her that. It was an intervention of one. There was no one else to fill the circle. She knew what to do about it and wasn't doing anything but drinking and stewing in self-pity. I'd grown up listening to all of her AA dogma and watched her coach newcomers into sobriety my whole life, even when she was only vaguely involved herself. As much as I might find AA to be bullshit, she still believed in it. She'd made it work for her for 20-some years. I asked her what she'd tell someone else who called her for help in a similar situation. She knew exactly what she'd say. This wasn't new territory for her. Get off your ass and follow your own advice. I can't be your constant middle-of-the-night savior from suicide. I'm already trying to figure out how to deal with mental illness, being a homeowner, and still be on the road most of the time. In January of 2006, Mother went back to AA, sobered up, and stayed that way until the night that she checked out for good. Except for my short stint in AA in Vegas when I was 19, I never made any serious attempt to quit drinking. Like anyone, I have those mornings where you question yourself, but that's always short-lived. I enjoy drinking. I enjoy being in bars. Airport bars and, to a lesser extent, hotel bars are my favorite. There's no regulars generally in an airport bar, and everyone's there for a limited time only. You can be anyone you want to be, and you never have to live up to it down the road. If the guy next to you is a bore, you know he's going to be gone soon. If you're shit-eyed and make an asshole of yourself, you're never going to see those people again anyway. The only times I've ever stopped drinking for any length of time, more than a couple of days, are on my attempts to quit smoking. I have to. 3 cocktails is about the limit before I reach for a pack, with, "Fuck it, you gotta die of something," dribbling out of the corner of my defeated mouth. I made one of those many attempts early on after I moved to Los Angeles. Hide in, lock the door, don't drink, and don't have cigarettes anywhere near you. I don't know how long that one lasted, but I do know that I get a phone call shortly into my self-imposed rehab. It was from a comedian I knew peripherally. He said that he'd heard I was trying to kick alcohol and wanted to help. I explained that I was just trying to quit smoking and that, in the meantime, booze was just an ancillary habit that had to be shelved in the process. He didn't listen and he didn't want to hear. He told me about his years in AA and that all I needed to do was reach out and he'd be there for me. Then he started to tell me about all the famous comedians he'd sponsor and helped sober up. So much for the anonymous part. But still, he sounded just like an agent. He sounded just like the network execs who were trying to woo me. He was pitching me. He dropped that he'd sponsored Bill Hicks like it was a movie credit. I didn't know how to react. I didn't know if that's just how everything worked in LA. I hung up feeling like I just got an offer for a development deal from Alcoholics Anonymous. Like church or witchcraft, AA is bullshit, but sometimes bullshit works for people. It worked for Mother for decades, Perhaps burning money in a voodoo seance would have worked as well. I've been outspokenly antagonistic towards AA in my adult life, on and off stage. Like any child who grew up in a strict religious upbringing and never questioned it until they became older, I felt duped by it in later life. I believed everything that Mother was buying in those early years in AA. Looking into it as an adult with a reasoned head, it's quite obvious that it's a pile of malarkey. Both statistically and anecdotally, it has no more success rate than quitting on your own. Its doctrine is misleading, erroneous, and sometimes outright false to the point where it can be dangerous. But, like Jesus, it might keep a few gunmen out of a watchtower. AA had worked for Mother, and on some levels, I'd have to say it probably worked for me. There's no way to tell how much of my stand-up career was influenced and inspired by sitting in the back of those meetings at the edge of my seat, listening to those provocative, tragic chronicles of people at their lowest and still managing to get laughs and acceptance. As my own act turned towards more dark storytelling, I could imagine those same stories coming out in a circle of folding chairs in the basement of a church as somebody else is bottoming out. To me, those stories aren't the bottom. They're the wealth. As a kid, I'd see people kill in AA meetings, and they knew it. They romanticized their lowest points, and they did it by design. The asterisk at the end about being grateful to the program for never having to revisit those times rang hollow. This isn't to say that those people should not have quit drinking. Mother certainly sucked at it, but it's worked for me this far. I remember when I used to drive without insurance in my early flat broke days. Eventually, I got pulled over and cited for it. I remember doing the math on the fine versus the cost of having insurance all those years. I made out like a bandit just paying the ticket. I feel the same way about drinking now at this age. Should my liver explode in the morning and I bleed out from yellowed eyes, I still come out well ahead for the good times I had. And I don't have to wrap up my stories in some disingenuous backpedaling of coerced remorse.
Mother was sober now, meaning that she no longer drank alcohol. What I hadn't known about is that she had developed a healthy Vicodin addiction, the roots of which are untraceable, possibly going back as far as Florida. Her back pain was constant, real, and rapidly getting worse. But she was doing nothing to help treat the source of the pain. Just trying to get more Vicodin. The amount of pills she was taking was far more than even lenient Bisbee doctors were willing to prescribe, and she had no luck finding them across the border. Naco, Mexico, a few miles away, is ripe with Xanax and Viagra, but shit for painkillers. She took to asking me to jack up my friends anytime they'd visit. She knew most of them dabbled in this or that, but I explained that painkillers were never a party drug people had around. That's like saying, "You do acid? Can you get me Lipitor?" When she wouldn't take my word for it, she'd call them herself. One friend, who actually was a walking pharmacy of pills, stayed at our house once while we were on the road, and Mother sniffed her out. Our friend told Mother that she had some painkillers and would gladly drop some by her place. Most people would have just said thank you. Mother took advantage by having her stop by three different stores on her way with a long list of her shopping needs. You know, since she was coming anyway. She had been manipulative her whole life, but now she didn't even try to be cute or cunning. She acted like things were owed to her. I had a hard time tolerating it. In 2007, I was gone for nearly 40 weeks. She had to take care of herself. She needed to figure out how to get on some kind of public assistance. Her body was failing her in every which way, not least her lungs. She coughed and wheezed like Ratso Rizzo in Midnight Cowboy and still smoked. It couldn't be my problem anymore, and it certainly couldn't be Bingo's. The ironclad rule was that Mother was not to bother Bingo when I was out of town. Bingo is as malleable as Play-Doh and is incapable of saying no even when her insides are screaming it. I could only imagine how badly Mother would abuse that weakness. Bingo was on her own roller coaster. Sometimes her meds worked and sometimes they didn't. If she was bad, she wouldn't come on the road. We wouldn't risk her having to be locked up in some fetid asylum in Rock Island, Illinois, or Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. If she spun out in Bisbee, we had people who could take care of her, and if she got locked up again, it'd be close to home. and it was only a matter of time. I'd left Bingo home at one point when her meds were sketchy. Father Luke was gone by now, and Bingo was left alone. I came home from the road to find she'd redecorated the house. Turns out she'd gone into a protracted manic state and spent 2 days driving around town removing road signs of everything from mile markers, street signs, animal control, even the sign for the local airport. Now she'd covered every wall in our house with them. I walked into the house and my jaw dropped with my bags. She was incandescent with delight. I scrambled like a cartoon to close all the blinds, horrified that the neighbors or the mailman might see or had already seen this. We already stood out as suspicious in this colorless neighborhood. Bingo looked like she was going to cry. In fact, I'm sure she did cry. "You don't like it?" she'd asked, like I'd opened a Christmas present, then thrown it directly in the trash in front of her. I tried to faux calmly explain to her that this was a major felony. I was like Darren from Bewitched, chastising Samantha for turning someone into a pygmy goat. There were 34 signs in total. I couldn't believe there were any signs even left in town. Some of them were huge. How the fuck she even managed to get them down and then up on the wall by herself can only be attributed to what was once called retard strength. The illegality of it all had never dawned on her. She just thought she was doing something nice for me and thought I hated it. I fucking loved it. I was awed by it, but we had to get these things back before she was put in jail, for fuck's sake. A missing stop sign could equal a manslaughter charge. "We're trying to fit into a new town, and this is what you do?" as Mother had said back in Paxton. I spent the night taking them off the wall and loading them into the back of her pickup truck. In the pre-dawn hours, I went out and left them on a dirt road that I knew Border Patrol used regularly and would find them. I'd considered going to the cops and being honest. But this was before I knew Bisbee cops were actual people with names. I only knew L.A. cops smashing my wife's face in and wasn't quite comfortable that they'd be at all understanding in Bisbee. Border Patrol must have turned them over because every one of them was back up within days. I hope I've more than made up for any costs incurred through charitable contributions around town in the years since. Bingo is well medicated now, but back then, every day was an adventure, with Benny Hill's Yakety Sax theme song constantly playing in my head as I cleaned up in her wake. We assumed that another lockup in the mental ward was a possibility, if not a probability, but we both preferred that than to try leaving her in the hands of Mother.
I was about to go on stage in Columbus, Ohio, when I get the call from Bingo from the back of an ambulance in Bisbee. She'd gone to the hospital when her mind started slipping hard. They were locking her up in Benson, about 50 miles away. They decided that she needed to come off one med while going on to another, always a dangerous time, and in the interim, they felt it safest to keep her confined and supervised. She was trying not to be afraid. But her problem was they wouldn't allow her to go home first to get any clothes or necessary items. She was taken immediately by ambulance in nothing but shorts and a tank top for an indefinite stay. They'd probably take away her phone, so she didn't know how to get a hold of me when she was admitted. She didn't know the name of the place they were taking her. She didn't even have shoes. The fact that she'd gone to the hospital without shoes in the first place surprised nobody. It was amazing she wore anything at all. I took all of this from the green room to the stage, and it wasn't a very good show. Greg Chaley, my tour manager, and I got into Louisville frantic the next day and immediately hit the thrift store to get clothes to FedEx to her. We walked into Goodwill, stopped, looked around for a second. Chaley says, "Okay, what exactly does she need?" "Everything. She has nothing. She doesn't even have shoes." And then our eyes locked as slow, evil grins crept up our faces, realizing she was going to have to wear whatever clothing we sent. We both grabbed carts and peeled off in opposite directions, grabbing everything and anything so long as it was completely ridiculous. Plus-size muumuus, sequin ball gown, acid-wash denim vest, one-piece old lady swimsuit, graduation hat, rubber bathing cap with plastic flower, winter parka. Chaley and I were literally running through the store with separate carts like it was Black Friday. We were so giddy that we almost forgot the shoes. I had no idea what size shoe she was, but that was no issue.
We found a pair of oversized novelty bedroom slippers designed to look like big cartoon sneakers, each one half the size of a bed pillow. We nearly had to stand on top of the huge shipping box to duct tape it shut. The Southeastern Arizona Psychiatric Health Facility was a small place and not part of any hospital. It was just a cinder block box there in the middle of nowhere for the handful of crazies it could hold, maybe 15 to 20 maximum. I never saw the place. Bingo was out in a week or so before I could get off tour. But the image of her stomping around in a prom dress and giant Charlie Brown slippers trying to tell people she was no longer crazy kept us pissing ourselves on the road. Bingo's mother, Gay, came down to take care of her at the house until I could get back from the road. Gay and her husband, Ron, are lovely people. They're retired professionals who live in Northern California, where Ron, pronounced Ron in Gay's thick Midwestern accent when she's yelling from across the room, runs his own hydroelectric power off a stream that runs through their property. It powers their whole house with the excess left to sell back to the electric company. Clever fucker, this guy. He had to create a corporation for the enterprise and asked us to come up with a name for the company. If it isn't obvious to you, it was to me, Gay Power. If you really love your wife and want to honor her, put that sign loud and proud in front of your house. Oh, did they laugh. But they never used the name. And it's only funny if you actually do it. In Bisbee, Bingo was full tilt, self-destructive, out of her mind. It was like having a newborn where you're up and down all night. Only you aren't changing diapers. This is a newborn who believed she'd invented her own surroundings, whose mission was to die, and who had access to the knife drawer. You don't get a lot of sleep with that baby. In Bingo's few lucid periods, Gay had the pleasure of meeting Mother, who was evidently quite forthcoming with her tales of jacking off her cats. I guess she had to piss on her territory of being not your average mother. Gay actually is your average mother, Mother. You can relax. I don't know if Gay were more scared for her daughter's well-being or of Mother. Gay would be too polite to say. Bingo was still in bad shape when her mother and I swapped out duties. I didn't know how to deal with it. I can deal with the crazy Bingo that was covering her entire bald head in blue Elmer's glitter glue and then sitting alone in the balcony to watch my show like some character out of The Fifth Element. But this was psychotic, seventh circle of hell loss of sanity, self-harming either by her own hand or loss of equilibrium. She fell onto the hardwood coffee table once squarely on her chin. The swelling made her look like Jay Leno until the bruising set in. Then we called her Abraham Lincoln for a week. I couldn't sleep because she'd wake up like a stumbling drunk and fall into every sharp edge in the house. My house had an old wall heater that was directly between where she slept and the bathroom. She was so unstable that I thought she'd fall into it and brand herself. The closest I'd ever come to dealing with mental illness was trying to talk someone out of a bad trip. Bingo's mental illness, from what I know, is very similar. If you've had one, rarely can someone talk you down. You just have to know it's a possibility going in, and if it happens, try like fuck to ride it out.
All right, that was some pretty heavy shit right there. So let's take a minute, go out, hug your pets, pet your wife. Do something enjoyable for you, because we can't get this deep. Yeah. We had a relationship. It was nice. And then there was a sad part. But it gets funny again. Then it gets sad again. Spoiler alert. Spoiler alert.
Chapter 20. My best friend again. Mother's declining health was speeding up as well. Her back problems were her lead complaint, but in the meantime, she'd had to have a stent put in an artery. Her blood pressure was fucked, and she'd been diagnosed with osteoporosis and put on oxygen for either emphysema or COPD, which, so far as I know, are the same fucking thing. Autism or Asperger's, your kid still isn't in the debate club. She tried her best to quit smoking, but even after being put on oxygen, she failed. I've smoked for 35 years at this point. I'm not going to say, but if I ever got to that point, I'd quit. I don't know that. But I hope like fuck I'd never continue to be the creator of my own demise and ask people to pick up the slack for me. The way an intervention is supposed to work is that those close to the person afflicted, or afflicting themselves, are told that if they don't change, they'll be written off. It's too much heartache for the people involved. I didn't do that with Mother. Meaning, I didn't tell her. I just stopped trying to intervene. Quietly, I had to write her off. From what I remember, which would be another appropriate title for this book if I hadn't had the good favor of friends who could fill in so many blanks, the write-off came when I got a call on vacation in Costa Rica that Mother had been life-flighted from Bisbee to Tucson. It had happened twice. This was her second time. We dropped everything and went directly to the airport in Liberia, Costa Rica. We finagled the most fucked-up flight home possible. From Liberia, Costa Rica, we flew to Miami. Then, after customs, caught a flight to Dallas. DFW is such a stupid fucking airport unless you were brought up with the alphabet the same way their tram works. A, C, E, D, B. We were told to go from A gates to B gates, meaning we were stuck on the tram for its entire run around the airport. Fuck me and fuck Texas. We missed our flight like they must have missed Sesame Street. Instead, we got on a flight to Vegas where we slept for 3 hours before going on to Phoenix and Tucson. 28 hours through 6 cities after leaving Costa Rica. I could only assume Mother was long since dead. We went straight to Tucson Medical Center. Mother had a male nurse named Graham who immediately recognized me. I assumed it was because Mother had forced one of my DVDs upon him. Turns out he was also a fledgling comedian in the area. That gave me some sense of comfort. Comedians are better than all other people. That is fact. When we got in to see Mother, she had a wide tube down her gullet and into her lungs, evidently sucking out gunk that was preventing her from breathing. Seems that when your lungs are that fucked, it doesn't take much of a cold to send you from wheezing to drowning in your own phlegm. I don't like hospitals. I get queasy from all things medical. I didn't like to see Mother with a hose jammed down her throat. She was awake, and that made it worse. I talked to her with questions that only required yes or no answers, as she obviously couldn't talk outside of nodding. I tried to keep it light. I reminded her that if nothing else, she got a free helicopter ride. She had no recollection of it. I didn't have much else to say. I didn't want to be there. I told her about our Phileas Fogg travel odyssey and said we had to leave. We had to get home to fall down. I'd been flying so long my sunburn had already peeled off. She picked up her pen and paper she'd been using to communicate with the staff. She wrote down one word. Vicodin was all it said. I said with incredulous sarcasm, "What the fuck? What do you want me to put it in your fucking IV?" She nodded a sincere and pleading yes. I rolled my eyes, told her I loved her with only frustrated surrender in my eyes, and walked out. This wasn't something she caught from someone else's sneeze, nor had it just creeped up on her. Before she'd even left Florida, she'd taken one of those tests where you blow in a machine to gauge your lung capacity. It told her she had the lungs of a 128-year-old. She thought it was kind of funny at the time. And this is how you wind up. I had looked at her in that hospital room, knowing that this was all caused by her inability to stop smoking cigarettes, and that made me angry. And that made me want a cigarette. So I gave up and went out to smoke angry cigarettes all the way back to Bisbee. When I say that I wrote Mother off, I don't mean that I cut off contact or deprived her of any financial support. I was still with her and helped out all I could. The write-off came in that I knew that I could no longer invest myself emotionally in trying to get her to help herself. Her time was now obviously limited, and she was doing nothing in the way of slowing that down. I wasn't going to spend the rest of it harping on her. It was too late for any of that to help, even if she'd chosen to make the effort. I'd just try my best to enjoy her and make her comfortable while she was here. Mother rarely left the house after she was discharged by the hospital, although she did continue to smoke despite being on oxygen now. She was insistent that she was still able and wanted to be in charge of shipping my merchandise. It was the only thing left that gave her a sense of purpose. That came to an end when I started getting emails from people saying that they'd ordered things weeks ago and it still hadn't arrived. I'd ask Mother about it, and she'd get irritated. "Tell them to fuck off. It's like TV commercials always said. Allow 6 to 8 weeks for shipping." That was the 1970s, Mother. You can't do that shit anymore. You may as well ship things COD on top of it. She was relieved of her duty. She cried and said that she felt like she was being fired. That was her one job that made her feel like she was contributing. I assured her that I was only concerned with her health. God knows what a dick I looked like having my mother drag packages along with an oxygen tank into the post office. It was time for someone else to cheap wrap and ship.
Her demise came rapidly. She'd kept detailed calendars or day-at-a-glance books going all the way back to the 80s. While the ones from years earlier were dotted with auditions and classes, the last year were basically a cryptic chronicling of her downward spiral. Some entries just said hot or cold for the weather. Other entries read bowels, diarrhea, AM and aft, back bad, or can finally stand on my own. The rest were mostly doctor's appointments and oxygen deliveries, and always notations of when I was leaving town, when I had called, and when I was coming home. I'd try to visit her, but I usually couldn't last for more than a few minutes. The less mobile she became, the more vulgar her apartment became, but her hoarder instincts wouldn't allow me to touch anything. Spiderwebs climbed over stacks of old mail. Packaged food that had long since expired wasn't allowed to be thrown away. Soon she was using bedpans and missing the target more often than not. It was a horrible way to see her exist, especially in that it was completely unnecessary. Aside from the dishes, she wouldn't let me clean up anything. She was afraid I'd throw things away. She was set in her ways and stuck in her landfill. Any casual suggestion to better her conditions just made her defensive and led to arguments. I had to let it be. I flew my brother and his two kids out that summer of 2008 to see her for the last time. We went to an old 70s-style steakhouse in nearby Palominos, similar to so many she'd worked in when we were kids. Her only steps were labored from the car to a wheelchair. These kids didn't know it would be their last time with Granny B, but if they'd been any older, they would have figured it out on their own. She was diagnosed terminal. She was placed under hospice care. Caretakers came by her apartment. When Jeff and I were kids, Mother loved to point out anyone in any state of disrepair, fat, stooped, or just generally fucked, and say, "Jesus, if I ever get like that, kill me." Now she was far worse than those people, but I didn't bring it up. I had to leave to do a 5-week tour of the UK. I was told that she had a 50-50 chance of being alive when I got back. Mother and I were more easy with comedy than we are with the sentimental, and I don't cancel gigs. So instead of some long heart-to-heart, I told her to try to stay alive till I got home. She said she would. I told her I'd call her on speakerphone live from the stage during every show to play the "Mother, Are You Dead Yet?" game, knowing that if she were still alive, she'd answer with her favorite line from our old Monty Python days of, "I'm not dead yet!" Otherwise, a caregiver or maybe a paramedic might answer the phone with bad news. Mother loved the idea. Vicariously, she'd get to be on stage every night, and there was that 50-50 gambling involved. Mostly, she'd know I loved her. I gave her a SkyMall catalog, and I encouraged her to buy as much shit on her credit card as she could. If you're gonna die, why would you die with $10,000 worth of Visa credit wide open? There's not gonna be any estate they can come after unless they want to get paid off in old cats and expired Hormel Completes meals. And I did that for most of the tour, explaining to the audience that we'd either get Mother on the phone or maybe the show's about to go sideways. If there's any way you want to find out someone you love is dead, it's on stage. Being on stage is like being in a fist fight. You never stop and say, "I gotta take a shit," or get melancholy about an old girlfriend. I did have to stop a show once in Aberdeen, Scotland to take a shit, but that was just from bad sashimi. But on stage, I was sure I could handle bad news just through sheer adrenaline. The audiences didn't seem to grasp that I was telling the truth and dealing with this in the best way I knew how. They were waiting for the payoff of the bit. There was no bit. I'd have Brian Hennigan pre-dial, so I'd just have to hit send, still not knowing how to dial international. Mother would answer with her best faux British accent, saying, "I'm not dead yet!" and then I'd go on to ask her what she bought that day on her Visa card. It generally went nowhere so far as comedy purposes, and almost always became a speed bump in the show. People were waiting for the punchline, and there wasn't one. By the time I got to London, I was too afraid of the critics, so I cut Mother out of the act. I still harbor some inner resentment towards the entire UK for that, even though it was just me cowering to a handful of cunt reviewers. Mother thought she hadn't been funny enough. It wasn't you, Ma. Sometimes, Mother, it really is the audience. She was alive when I got home. I kind of knew she would be, and she said she did too. We high-fived. We knew it wasn't going to be much longer, no matter how it ended. I knew she was in agony with shallow, gurgling breaths, and there was nothing I could do about it. Now it was just a matter of waiting. It was a matter of whether she goes naturally before she has a chance to do it herself. Her history of suicide attempts or threats ranged from age 14 into her drinking days in L.A. and into Bisbee, and those were all rooted in depression. But in between those, she always made clear, unemotional comments that she'd kill herself before she ever lived in a terminal state. Back in 2004, I released a DVD that included a bit about Mother's eventual suicide, imagining her going out as a suicide bomber. The premise was built on when Mother kills herself, not if. She'd always been aware and open to the possibility that this day might come. In her present state, I'd be foolish to think she wasn't considering the option. Outside my house was a clusterfuck of construction when I got back from the UK. Bingo had decided to surprise me while I was away for 5 weeks by having a 6-foot corrugated metal fence built around the entire 4 lots to the tune of $17,000. She'd get a puppy who kept burrowing under the old 3-foot picket fence and decided that rather than train the fucking dog, we needed a new fence with an underground foundation. Surprise! They'd originally built it in even more garishly offsetting 8- and 10-foot slabs of rusted metal until after a complaint, the building inspector came and made them cut it down to 6 feet, citing city codes. Nobody here has a house that's up to code. I don't know how to impart to you how difficult it is in Bisbee to have someone complain that your house is too weird, but they did it. The mailman came by when I'd just pulled up and asked me if I was trying to start my own third world country. I'd just got back home and was thinking the same thing. I didn't try to explain because I didn't know either. I had worse shit to deal with. Bingo's parents showed up to visit. They're wonderful people who give you hope that not every gated community person is a fuckhead. Maybe they're just as afraid of juvenile delinquents as I am, since I was one. They didn't know what they were walking into. In the best of times, coming home from a tour like that is where the work really begins. There's bills to pay, paperwork, and getting all your shit back together. Unpack, repack, call people back. Pet your pets, reconnect, do laundry. And now there's construction in the yard, in-laws, and my mother's about to die. How do you handle it all? Cocktails, goddammit, and quick. No time to try to reinvent the wheel. When I got the call from Mother's caretaker that I should come over to talk, I'd already run it over in my mind so many times that I was numb. I went over to her place like a plumber going to work. Mother's timing was perfect in that the in-laws were already planning on leaving that night. Once I determined that Mother wasn't fucking around and would be at the house at any moment, I told the construction people to take a long weekend. Bingo's parents were now informed that Mother was on her way over to die. They were not weaned into this information. They were not told to sit down, we need to talk. There was no time for that. We told them flat out and they took it in stride. They'd already planned on taking off that night, but now even offered to stay around to help. They were more than courteous, or possibly they just didn't want to be seen as fleeing a sinking ship. Either way, I knew the last thing Mother wanted while she was at her gurgling worst was trying to make pleasant with the in-laws she barely knew. So I frog-marched Bingo into the kitchen. No time for indirect hinting or insinuation. The parents had to be told to be on their way. I'm sure that they were secretly relieved to hear this, though they'd never admit it. Nevertheless, the Binghamman's sense of manners and awkward decency meant that there was going to be a happy hour cocktail before they shoved off, the drinks being in consideration of us as they don't normally imbibe. Mrs. Binghamman made some lovely amaretto-based concoction, and we all stood around sipping it like we were waiting for Santa Claus, everyone ignoring the iron-lunged elephant in the room. The in-laws leaving made everyone wheeze a sigh of relief. Bingo, Mother, and I could rise to the occasion so long as we didn't have to put on a fake face. I honestly love Ron and Gay, but I wouldn't have wanted to be there when they had to tell their daughters why they were getting their first period. This wasn't a time for that kind of intimacy either. From that point Thursday evening until Saturday night, the house was largely peaceful. Mother would doze off now in mid-sentences and then wake up later with some smart fuck remark as though she'd been listening to our entire conversation the whole time and then drifting back into a morphine haze. She'd still be surly with Betty when she made her rounds. She'd spring to lucidity in order to excoriate whatever guests were on Maury Povich or whatever nonsense TV she'd have on, as though that was of paramount concern. Maybe it was. Those people are morons, and maybe Mother felt it needed to be pointed out one last time. And the rest of the email from Tamar.
One day, I emailed Doug to tell him how much I enjoyed his book about trapping pedophiles online, which Bonnie had sent me after I sent her the awards from Memphis Bound and Gagged for her new apartment in Bisbee. Doug replied, adding, "Mother would like to hear from you. She's not doing so well." I got on the phone and she said simply, "I'm dying. But don't worry about it. How are you?" I told her about my third film and how it was being considered for a film festival in Tucson. "If it gets in," I told her, "how about I visit?" She was excited. Before we hung up, she said, "I'll wait for you." "Wait." She also asked me if I had any narcotics. I laughed it off nervously, but true to Bonnie form, she was serious. I stammered I might have two or three from a car accident years before, somewhere in the medicine cabinet. "Send them to me," she said. When I tried to argue, she told me she had a terrible back pain and because of the rehab, she couldn't get any good prescriptions. And why the fuck not? She's dying after all. I sent the three measly pills in the back of my medicine cabinet the next day. A month later, I called to say the festival had accepted the film and I was coming out. "Great," she said. "I'll wait for you." I asked if the pills helped. "No," she said. "They were too old." I apologized. I called her from Tucson to make plans to come down the next day. She says she's just moved into Doug's house, but doesn't say why exactly. I tell her I'll be there midday. She responds with a cheery, "Oh, I'm waiting for you." I arrive wholly unprepared for the hospital bed in the middle of Doug's living room, the oxygen tank hissing into the double set of nose tubes she's wearing, the tiny, skinny woman who jokes that I wasn't ready to see this, but here she is, and look how my fake boobs are still huge. That shit don't shrink when you're sick. She still has two or three cats, but one of them is hiding under the bed, hyperventilating, and the other disappeared out the front door. So Bonnie has me canvassing the Bisbee Desert neighborhood, calling out, "Bottoms," or "Hanky," or whatever the missing cat's name was. I'm out there for a half an hour, peeking under cars. I get back and Bonnie and I review every memory of every moment we've shared, including that one cunt actress. We talk for hours with Bonnie taking breaks to pull her oxygen tubes out of her nose so she can hoover down a cigarette. She's small, like concentration camp small, but she's still hilarious and honest. She asks me how long I'm staying and I say I need to be back in Tucson for a late dinner with my family. She says she wants me to stay the night. The people in Tucson aren't dying. She actually says that and I say, okay. She dozes off and I retreat into the kitchen where Doug and Bingo have an envious collection of airplane booze. They make me a drink, and then another. As I relax, I realize I'm an interloper. Doug is losing his mother in his living room. Bonnie wakes up when the hospice nurse arrives. She demands we all watch Bad Santa together. She dozes off after and I'm back in the kitchen. I tell Doug she's asked me to stay the night. We discuss it, and instead I kiss her on the forehead and tiptoe out. I get a speeding ticket in Tombstone, and by the dawn, Bonnie has left, taking all the pills she squirreled away.
People die. Rarely do people have the opportunity to die knowingly, surrounded by their loved ones and nearly counting it down like it was New Year's Eve. I don't know anyone who's had the fortune, freedom, or fortitude to die like Mother. That's not to say that there was no fear or sorrow in her or in us. But with Mother, there was humor. There were outright belly laughs, for fuck's sakes. How could that possibly be wrong? Everybody dies. Maybe we're just different. When I die, I don't want to be surrounded by a bunch of morose cunts praying and rubbing beads. That Saturday night when Mother decided to exit the stage for good was the most courageous I'd ever seen her or ever seen anyone. She simply quit, like the way you quit a job that sucked for too long. Throw off the apron and tell the boss to go fuck himself as you feel that freedom and empowerment envelop you as you walk out the door. Mother quit living like it was a shitty day job. She just decided one day she'd had enough and that was that. Hit the bar for a drink and a smoke, few good laughs about the old days, and we'll see you out there somewhere. And in the morning, she was gone. There was nobody I could think to call. Mother was 63 years old and had burned out or run away from all of her friends by this point in life. Aside from my brother and his kids, she had no other family. There was no need for an obituary. If I had been inclined to write one, it would have just been a litany of everything she hated and everyone she complained about in Bisbee. And that would have been funny, but I didn't think of it till it was too late. There was not much in the way of tying up loose ends. Her body was donated to some foundation that does something with dead things. Scientific research, cadavers for medical students, Moroccan food. I have no idea. She wouldn't care, nor did we. They sent her ashes back months later. I tried to sell them on eBay with all the proceeds going to the Humane Society, but the auction was shut down within hours. Seems selling dead people is not only against eBay policy, it's against federal law. Feds must not like cats like Mother did. So now her ashes are in a drawer or a box around here somewhere, not quite sure. I've become a bit of a hoarder myself. My father died with a cemetery plot bought and paid for, coincidentally just across the street from that old house where we lived with Mother and John Kirk in Paxton. We talked about putting a gravestone on the plot with the old "I'm with stupid" finger pointing towards the sky. Never get around to it. Like Mother, he's still just a bag of ashes somewhere in my brother's hoard. Years ago, we talked about mixing his ashes in some cocaine and snorting him, just for the story value. We laughed like pigs, but we never did it. Not long afterwards, Keith Richards made international headlines by saying he'd done that very thing with his own father's ashes. When you have a great idea, get it out there before someone beats you to the punch. It's only funny if you actually do it. Mother didn't have any estate aside from her last cat, Georgia, who lived another disheveled year and a half. Mother's bills could all gather spiderwebs now. All Bingo and I had to do was clean out her apartment one last time. I thought it would be easier now that she was dead, but it was even more difficult. The minute you die, so many things you cherished in your life become immediately worthless. Mother's framed certificates from massage and nursing schools hung on the walls. I kept them, but I had to ask myself why. I'm never going to hang them on my wall, nor will my brother or his children. Am I supposed to leave them in my own crawl space and make them someone else's problem when I croak? Yet to just chuck them in a dumpster that quickly seemed even too callous for me. Best to just keep them for a while and eventually give them to a thrift store for some other hoarder. They'll use the frame someday for something, and only for $1.50. The infuriating thing about the dump that Mother left behind was that although she considered it organized, there was still no rhyme or reason to it. I'd go through stacks of old electric bills dating back to the 90s, and just before I was about to throw out the whole fucking box, you'd find an envelope full of sequentially ordered 1976 $2 bills straight from the mint, or my great-grandmother's original birth certificate from Scotland. That means now I'd have to go through every slip of paper to make sure I'm not throwing away something valuable, and I'm glad that I did. I would not have been able to write this book had it not been for her keeping the boxes that I saved. all of her old weekly planners, calendars, records, resumes, greeting cards, pictures, and letters helped me piece together so many holes in my memory. I know the cost of my delivery where I was born at Fairlawn Hospital was $251.58. She'd kept the canceled check. I now know that I didn't use my credit card on 9/11. For some reason, she kept some of my old bills in her boxes. I can hear her saying, "I told you so," from the grave, or from some drawer somewhere around here, as it were. Mother lived a life rooted in fear, frustration, and loneliness, with bouts of great bravado and boldness. Towards the end, it was mostly remorse, reflection, and regret. Being around her in those later years was trying, but also cathartic. I was slowly becoming like her. Everything I carped about to her were things I was tacitly telling myself. Get outside, eat healthier, stop complaining about every fucking thing, find something positive, enjoy yourself. All things I could stand to be improving more on in life. I was understanding her insanity. I was seeing my own ghost of Christmas future in her. I still do, and even when it's just finding myself mimicking one of her eccentricities or shortcomings, I miss her. I had a couple of shows on the East Coast that followed the weekend after she died. I don't cancel shows for dead people. Anyone familiar with my comedy knows that recent devastating loss or personal tragedy isn't going to dampen the spirit of my performance. That's generally already woven into the seams. The first show after she died was at an awful, great punk rock bar called The Milestone in North Carolina. My musician friend Mishka Shibali was opening for me. In the green room before the show, he asked me tentatively how I was holding up. I don't remember it, but he does. He said that I just stared off into the distance and said softly that I didn't have anyone to call anymore when I had great stories to tell. Even at the worst of times, she was always the only one I was playing to, on stage and off.
Sidebar, director's commentary, Mishka Shibali here on the audiobook.
Yeah, that passage is totally wrong. I know the Milestone because I played in at the Milestone in 2008 with my old band, and they had an axe handle behind the bar wrapped in barbed wire. And for a shot of Everclear, I let some redneck hit me in the guts with it. It's funny, man, like to go and read your book now, because I was going through, you know, I was going through a lot of shit at that point. That's when I was doing a lot of the,
I've read your book. Yes. Around the same time. Yeah. A lot of shit.
And I was doing, I was doing so much of this painkiller that like every time I woke up in the morning, I was surprised that I woke
hang
up.
Hang on. We're always branding on the audio book. So what kind of painkiller?
Opana.
Opana.
Yeah, yeah. Which I found out later is basically pharmaceutical heroin.
You speak highly of it in your book until you don't.
Yeah. True love. But yeah, I mean, I was in so much trouble at that time that I had no idea what was going on in your life. And then so to go and read the book now and find out, and that was one of the things, that's why that moment was so terrifying for me, is because you had always been the sort of calm guy at the center of the hurricane when all this bullshit was going on. And I was always, scared that somebody was going to die or we were going to get arrested or just that. I mean, I went home from that weekend throwing up blood. And that moment with you, like, definitely scared the shit out of me, man, because we'd already been through so much just weird times, bad times, good times, and nothing ever seemed to faze you. And that was the first time where you seemed a little shaken, you know, just for that was the first time I'd seen you even, like, blink.
Well, to this day, when all your friends are industry people, you can't brag. You can't name drop. You can't go, "Hey, I get a thing," because people are just, they don't want to hear about it.
Yeah. Nobody cares.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, my brother is the last guy that I have left that I can name drop shit. And he doesn't even care anymore. But yeah, mother was the last person that was really excited about any dumb shit.
Yeah. That's the thing about, about moms and their sons is, you know, like, if you make a big poop. She's like, wow, look at the big poop you made.
You know? Even if you're in your 40s.
Yeah. Mom, look, it's coiled like a snake. But yeah, there's no funny story behind it. It was just, that was a fucking dark, scary time. It sort of shook me.
Every person that's in the book that I've talked to goes, I remember it differently.
Yeah. Yeah.
But as we talked about, there's no such thing as history. I did a bit about it where all history is bullshit because you can't even recreate what happened Saturday night. Yeah. No, that's when the bull dyke chick came up with the pool cue and she had quarters up. No, the dude had quarters up. She said it was her quarters. No, anyway, all the next thing I know, drambuie, whatever. Yeah, it's all to the best of our recollections. And everyone has a different version.
I just remembered how you opened that show in Virginia, too. You got up there and there was, you know, sort of like a pregnant pause. And then you said, I don't know if you guys know, mother died the other night. And then there was just silence. And I was like, oh, fuck. And then you reworked the bit later. But it took me
like 5 years to rework that bit.
It was like 7 minutes with no laughs. Until you finally let people laugh. And then it was just a laugh of gratitude. Like, oh, mercy, dog, show us mercy. Let us fucking laugh here. Oh my God. Everybody was just so terrified. Great show.
It was a fun night. We like to have fun. All right. Now let's get back to that audiobook where I'm not nearly as drunk and strung out. In the horde, there was an undated yet timeless Valentine's Day card she sent to me. I don't know if it's from her hoard or my own. The text inside the card reads, "This is an invitation to remain close to me always. It's my way of expressing the beautiful feelings that you've awoken in my heart. I want you to know I will follow you wherever you go." And Mother continued after this sappy sentiment in a spiral around the card.
"I will follow you to your bathroom, your kitchen, your bedroom. I will hire a bagpipe band to serenade you through your worst hangover. I will spout dirty limericks at the top of my lungs until I get you to understand that you are an incredibly wonderful human being with a tender heart, a fascinating, inventive, imaginative mind, a warm and fun and funny guy, and one of the two greatest gifts God gave me. I love you, my son. Ma."
This is a love story.
This has been an Audible Studios production of Digging Up Mother, a Love Story. Written by Doug Stanhope. Performed by Doug Stanhope and friends. Executive producer Keith O'Connell and Mike Charzik. Producer Bruce Katovich. Directed by Bruce Katovich and Greg Shaley. Edited by Brian Corcoran. Copyright 2016 by Doug Stanhope. Forward copyright 2016 by Johnny Depp. Production copyright 2016 by Audible Inc. Audible Studios is a division of Audible Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.